This podcast is for alcoholics that have a willingness to recover from their alcoholism by being taught and practicing the principles of the 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book and the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Ilya, and I am an alcoholic. Page XIII, forward to first edition, first paragraph. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Up until this point, we've done a lot of work on ourselves. 1 through 7 primarily deals with the individual. And now we are moving into dealing with other people and how we impacted their lives through our disease, as well as how the world and all its people we have found to blame for our problems. So what we need to do now is ultimately build relationships by repairing the damage that we have done while in our drinking days, and also recreate our lives to help others moving forward. And without including others in our lives, and repairing the damage that we've caused, everything we've done in this up until this point will have no basis for our recovery unless we share ourselves with the rest of the world and those close to us in our innermost circles, and also people that we come in contact with on a daily basis that we don't really have a relationship with ongoing, but we do encounter other people as we go throughout our day. How are we going to treat them? The people at shopping malls and people we share the road with. These types of people that we interact with may not be ongoing relationships, but they certainly are part of our lives in certain moments. So if we don't consider others, and that's why Bill introduced consideration of others is inconsiderate as a character flaw when we went over the relationship or the sex/relationship inventory and how it works. Bill introduced inconsideration, and we can't be inconsiderate of others if we expect to stay sober, because that's a major character flaw. And if we treat others how we wouldn't want to be treated, then we become very disrespectful and rebellious and could end up drinking over it. So we've discussed up until this point how we take inventory in steps 4 and 5 by getting to the truth. And then in 6 and 7, we've discussed willingness and humbly asking for our higher power's help to remove these character flaws. So now that we have done that, we need to find the willingness to make amends to those we have harmed. So first thing we're gonna do is make a list. And then we become willing. So just because I make a list doesn't mean that I'm necessarily willing. But I do know that they need to go on to the list. I can revert back to my fourth step inventory and look at the harms to others sheet. And between steps 4 and 7, I might have come to realize that there are others that I've harmed that didn't make the fourth step inventory. So that's why it's good to always have a pad and paper next to you. So when a name pops into your mind, and you realize and the awareness comes back that you did harm somebody, they make the list. So what we need to do is have an ongoing list. And you, even though you're not willing to maybe make amends to them yet, we never want to say never. And you can put them into three different categories: a now category, a maybe inventory category, and a never category. Keeping in mind that that's how you may feel now, that you never will make amends, but you know you should. In your heart of hearts, but they harmed you too much for you to give to have the willingness, even though that there's damage and harm that you've caused. They, in your mind, caused more damage and harm. Therefore, weighing that out, you've decided that you're not willing. So that's okay. Put them on the never list, and the idea is to move people from left, from right to left. So you have the nows, the maybes, and the nevers, and then when you move people from never to maybe, and then maybe to now, and then now to actually making the amend. That's the idea. It's not an overnight matter, and it can take years to get to some of these people, but we'll get into that shortly. So we're going to go back to the big book. We've read the seventh step prayer. And we talked about the seven steps. So that brings us back to page 76 of the big book, where we talk, where we're going to read the third full paragraph. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at step 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. So that summarizes, the fact that we have to repair damage that we have caused, as well as do things that we don't want to do. He ends it with saying we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Now, if you've gotten to step 7, you may feel like, what's the use? Why should I do this? I'm not drinking. I'm fine. Why bring other people into this? We'll talk about that shortly, but in the short of the long of it is that you will continue to have guilt and remorse in your subconscious and possibly your conscience if you don't. And guilt, people drink over. So that will come back to haunt you if you don't use the gift God has given you, your higher power has given you, and has removed these character flaws, which is fear. Mainly fear of not doing this. So if you've asked your higher power to remove fear, which is what you should have done in 7, in addition to selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and inconsideration, you should now have enough courage to go out there and speak to your sponsor about each situation and try to repair the damage, because you won't be in extreme fear. And we'll get into some of the ins and outs of why we don't want to do this in a moment, but that's the long and the short of it, to not drink over the guilt and remorse of the damage we have caused. So you've done a self-appraisal, and now we need to bring other people into it and repair the damage that we've caused, in one way or another. So in any event, we will, in my experience, 8 and 9 were side by side steps, just like 4 and 5 are side by side steps, and 6 and 7. So now we're entering, another section of the program, and within this program, we're dealing with within this part of the program, we're dealing with other people, not just our sponsors, but other people that we have had a relationship with in the past. So sexual or not. So now let's read on to the next paragraph. We're going to go to the fourth full paragraph on 76. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be assured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature of our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put ourselves in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. So I'm going to stop there for a minute. It's a long paragraph. I have underlined that last sentence. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That is the entire point of this process of steps 8 and 9. We are not trying to humiliate ourselves. When we make amends, we are being of maximum service to others and to God. And if we do that, we are able to be in God's will. So when I repair damage that I have caused to another human being, I am carrying out God's will for me in that moment. And that is the point, not to try to get forgiveness and have an outcome to my liking. The outcome is up to God and to my higher power. Whatever the result of the amend is not up to me. And so I have to be accepting of that going into it. So if I go into it boasting how spiritual I've become, I'm really trying to make myself look good, and that could prejudice the other individual. So right now, I'm not trying to go and show off that, oh, look at me, I'm very spiritual now, so therefore you owe me forgiveness. As you can see, that's pride and asking for something in return, which is forgiveness. That may be the outcome. They may forgive me, they may not forgive me, but that's not the point. We're trying to get our own life in order. So that's why, without humility and an understanding of that, one could go out there and create more damage and more distrust by the individual that we're making amends to than if we had done nothing at all. So we'll continue. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our aim is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. So that basically backs up what I just said. We're leading with the chin. That's what they call in the prize ring. It's pride, and we're going in there trying to convince them that religion is the answer. Nobody wants to hear that. It's you trying to push your will down their throats on how to be a spiritual person. That's just more of the same that we've been giving them before. We found this program, and it doesn't really show any change in the alcoholic at all. So, a good demonstration of goodwill. Well, what's a demonstration of goodwill? Well, it is how can I repair the damage that I've caused? I'm admitting my character flaws. I am asking or willing to make amends to repair the damage. Maybe they would want involvement on how I would do that. Obviously, if they're emotionally ill, they may ask for you to do things that are unreasonable, but that's why you have a sponsor to make sure that you're not, being taken advantage of, and that your wrong aligns with the reparations. But then the last thing that you want to explain to them is that you're trying to change. So you admit where you were wrong, you do what you can to repair the damage, and then you explain that you're trying to change. That's a demonstration of goodwill. And so we try to do that, and that's all you can do. You can't change the past. You can't make every right, every wrong a correction, but you can fix it to the best of your ability. And sometimes that can take a lifetime, depending on the relationship, or it can be a simple conversation. Maybe financial restitution, and then they're out of your lives. But you still never cleaned up that mess. You ran from it. So now you need to repair it. And maybe they're not in your lives after that moment. But maybe, it's a parent or somebody that you need to make living amends to and constantly be making amends through your new actions and behaviors is how you do that. We don't want to be shy about this. We need to have confidence in doing so, and the only way we can do that is to do steps 1 through 7 before we get to this step. So now I'm becoming willing. So Bill Wilson puts 8 and 9 together. He's saying they're side by side when he says now we come to 8 and 9. So you can connect the two together, but we break them in for this purpose of this exercise, of this learning exercises. We need to even break it down further into two separate steps. So the first part being the list and the willingness. And then once we have that completed, then we can approach an individual and make the direct amend wherever possible. That being if it doesn't hurt anybody else while you do it. So let's read on. We're now on the first full paragraph on 77 towards the middle of the page. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Now, again, stopping there. Faults, again, are the same as wrongs, character defects, and shortcomings and mistakes. Bill uses the word faults in this sentence. Now, faults are the same five things. So you're admitting what? Where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, fearful, and inconsiderate of others? So that's what I'm admitting. Those are my faults. So to continue. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. So there's two types of people. Again, I had suggested you do a now list, a maybe list, and a never list. It's harder to go to an enemy. I usually put them in the never list because they harmed me more than I harmed them, in my opinion, at the beginning of this podcast. And then they, are harder to make amends to. But I take the bit in by the teeth, and I muster the courage to approach this individual and clean up my side of the street. And he talks about maybe I will bring up a religious or a spiritual conviction. I don't know. It says to use tact and common sense. It depends on the situation and who I'm talking to. So I can't give you advice whether to bring that up or not. But if you go in there with it in your head that I'm going to show this person I'm a better man, and I'm going to say religion saved me, and if they don't have religion, then they're doomed, and now they better forgive me, I am missing the entire point of this process, and I will only create more resentment on their end, and I will create more resentment in me because they are not going to react the way that I wish. And so I'm basically still in my ego and trying to run the show. And I have no humility whatsoever if I take that approach. That is what Bill's trying to say here. And I have, in my own experience, tried to make amends prematurely. And I had to make amends for the incorrect amends after I gained humility. So when I skip to step eight, right out of step two and three, and skip four through seven and try to make amends in nine, with no humility, I make more mistakes. And then when I actually work the middle part of the program, I realize, oh wow, I made it worse than if I had done nothing at all. So now I have to make amends for the incorrect amends. And that is not easy. If you can avoid that, I highly recommend it. Please be patient, until the time is right. You will know when you're doing these steps in order or if you're trying to skip to the end. So in page 77, we're now at the bottom of the second full paragraph. Excuse me, we're at the bottom of the page at the second full paragraph. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell them that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. So that is the most difficult part of the step. When you're in the middle of making an amend, they may start telling you that you're a jerk. You've done things that were totally inappropriate, and then we have the inclination to say, "Well, yeah, but if you didn't scream at me that day, I wouldn't have gotten out of control, and it was kind of like, we both played a part. That is not right." You don't bring up under, it says under no condition do we criticize a person. If they want to yell, if they want to scream, and that's their way of getting the anger off their chest, then we sit back and I hate to say it, but you just take it. You sit there and listen, and the only words that should come out of your mouth are thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You're listening and you're taking the information in without relaying any criticism whatsoever. It is difficult to do because our pride is taking a beating and we want to rationalize why they got what they deserved, to be honest. And that is not the approach, and it's not easy to do. But remember, it says we can tell them, if that comes to it, if it gets heated, or not. It depends, if you want to tell them that this is a matter of drinking. Not every amend you're going to bring up that you're trying to recover from alcoholism. It depends on how well they know you and how well you know them. But in this particular case, in this sentence, yes, we are telling them, look, I will never overcome drinking until I have done what I can to straighten out the past. And I have hurt you, either physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually. And these were my wrongs or my character defects. And I would like to try to repair the damage. And I am ultimately trying to change. That's all you can do. That's cleaning up your side of the street. So I don't know. There's multiple situations that we can cause harm. You'll have to go over with your sponsor on each individual case what the repair of the damage should be. But up until this point, doing four through seven, you should know what your character flaws are. And if you've made it this far, you should know that you're trying to change. So you can do that. You can admit those. But the actual specifics of the damage that needs to be repaired is each by a case on a case-by-case basis. That is how you're going to clean up your side of the street. Having a conversation is not enough. If you say you're going to repair damage, you better be prepared to do so. Otherwise, it's more lip service and more dishonesty, and that is a character defect. So we don't discuss their flaws, we don't criticize them, and we explain what we're trying to accomplish as a result of our drinking and our alcoholism. And if we can do that with a calm, frank, and open mind, we will be gratified with the result, no matter what their reaction. So that is extraordinarily important paragraph, and you need to read more about this in steps 8 and 9 in the 12 and 12 to understand why we have to do this, and why and how we rationalize to not do it. So Bill says in Sev 78 in the first full paragraph, in 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter. However, if someone does throw us out of his office, we have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. So now we see that 9 out of 10 times our worst fears don't come true, but 1 out of 10 they could. They could throw us out of their office and scream and yell at us. But at that point, that isn't your problem. And you just wish them well in your heart and understand that they are emotionally ill because they have to react the way they have. But 9 out of 10 times, it says here that people actually start to admit their own faults, and you basically melted the ice and gave them an opportunity to do so as well. And so you're going to feel good about the progress, and even enemies will even become friends in some cases and actually try to help you. So these outcomes are not up to you. They are up to your higher power as long as you follow these directions of what to do and what not to do. So Bill gets into another instinct that is financial when it comes to making amends in the next paragraph. Financial instinct is a powerful base instinct within each of us, and we have taken advantage of people financially. And so he gives an example here on what to do when it comes to money that we owe. So you can read that. If, in my opinion, making financial amends was pretty simple. If I stole, I paid it back. If I borrowed and didn't pay it back, I set up a schedule to do so. If I can't afford to pay it back, I pay what I can every month. Even if I owed tens of thousands of dollars, and the best I can do is give back maybe $100 a month, I will do so. I will send a check for $100 a month until it's paid, or until I have more money to send more money. But I have to make a beginning. I can't do nothing, and I need to address the financial amend and do what I can. Not what's impossible. If I dream of doing the impossible, I don't do anything at all. But it is possible to send sometimes even $5 a month, whatever it is. Just continue to create a plan and a strategy to pay back. Now, some debts you may feel like you don't owe, or the individual may say, don't worry about it. It's not something you feel obligated to pay. Thank you for just admitting that you owe me the money, but you don't have to pay me the money. Those are dangerous situations as well, because they're people pleasing you. They may not need the money, and they may want to help you by not making you pay it back. But in fact, it could be hurting your program. There are ways to pay them back, even though they say don't worry about it. So I highly recommend that you pay them back in some shape or form, even if they tell you not to worry about it. Because the guilt and the remorse still will sit within you, even though that they seemingly let you off the hook. Your higher power has not let you off the hook, and you will feel the results of not doing anything, which is more guilt. So that's just from experience. If you owe your parent money and they say forget it, there are ways to repair that damage, whether they say don't worry about it or not. So that is something you'll want to discuss with your sponsor. And then he gets into criminal offenses, and I'm going to let you read all of this. But criminal offenses means that I may go to jail if I admit that I committed a crime. And then my family will be out on the street because there'll be no breadwinner to bring the money in. In that case, yes, that's the second half of the ninth step. Does it cause harm to other people? Well, if I'm in jail and my kids and my wife can't eat, then yes, I'm being selfish. I'm admitting a harm to ultimately put me in jail, and my kids and my wife may not have a roof over their head. So unless I can make sure they're okay, I shouldn't do that. But if I have to admit to a crime and nobody's going to be hurt as a result of that, then yes, the book is telling me that I need to go ahead and admit my faults to those I've harmed, as long as nobody else is going to get hurt as a result of that. Extramarital affairs, for example. Is it really going to help to tell my spouse that I've cheated on her while I was drinking? Or is it best to just admit that there were extramarital affairs, but if she asks who was it, right, then I would be harming the individual that it was with by telling my wife who it was. I'm, not in order to save my own skin and my own conscience, I can't throw other people under the bus. And that is really what this is basically saying. If I'm throwing other people under the bus, in order to clear my own conscience, I should not make that amend. So it would not be possible in that case without harming another human being. And that, again, is why we should not take any drastic measures without discussing each scenario with our sponsor. And we will try to talk our sponsor into why we shouldn't make an amend. And it's hopefully their job, if they're a good sponsor, to explain to you, no, nobody's going to be harmed here. You're just afraid to do it, or you're blaming the other party, or you're in denial that anything was done on your part. So usually blame, denial, and fear are the three things that prevent us from moving forward with making an amend. And it's up to a conversation with your sponsor to break through that, see if nobody will be harmed, and if that's the case, then we proceed and we do it regardless of the outcome, even if it is jail. And that is what we need to do, depending upon each case. So we don't shrink at anything, because if we run the show on how we make amends when no one else is going to be harmed, you will be what? That's a character defect, dishonest. And we're also in fear of the outcome. Okay, so that is why we do these amends. So he goes through, all the basic instincts that prevent us from doing this. So now we're going to jump ahead here. We're going to go to page 80, and we're going to read the bottom paragraph, all the way at the bottom, the last paragraph. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who's literally gone through hell for him. So remember, this book was written in the 30s, and it's always the guy who goes out and does the cheating, but we're in a new society now, and so you can reverse the gender in this paragraph and read it that way. My sponsor, would read this in a meeting, and all the women would roll their eyes and go, of course, it's the man. He's a cheater. He's a pig. And then he'd go, all right, well, let's read it the other way. Chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with men in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a husband gets worn out, resentful and uncommunicative. How could he be anything else? The wife begins to feel lonely, sorry for him, for herself. She commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps she is having a secret and exciting affair with the boy who understands. In fairness, we must say that he may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A woman who's so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if she is married to a loyal and courageous boy who has literally gone through hell for her. So it's the same thing, you know, it's just so easy, you know, our alcoholic minds, especially, you know, if you're a woman, may just immediately go, oh, it's a man's fault. But if you reverse the genders and read it, it actually makes still perfect sense. There are many women who cheat as well, who have, you know, who are alcoholics and leave a good guy suffering in the backdrop. So let's not fool ourselves and think that this is a gender-based thing. This isn't a Me Too movement book. It is a book about the alcoholic, whether they're a woman or a man. And resentments over gender are just as alive today as they were yesterday. So let's try to keep a clear head on gender roles. In any case, I've had experience where I was married to an alcoholic and had girlfriends that were alcoholics, so we were both doing this to each other. I can imagine an alcoholic married to a non-alcoholic, and the non-alcoholic suffering immensely as a result of the alcoholic behavior. That means that, you know, if I am treating my wife, in my case, unfairly, of course, she's going to look for help, and hopefully Al-Anon is a choice that she would have, because Al-Anon is for people who are in relationships with alcoholics, and they need help too. So that's just a suggestion. So what do we do? You know, how far should we take our amends? Well, in the next paragraph, it tells us. So, whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take. So, whether you're the guy or the girl, you know, or the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic, the alcoholic has to go as far as they can spiritually without harming another. That is the idea. How far should I go to create an amend, to make an amend spiritually, where I do not harm another human being? That is the prong test. Okay? That is the prong test, two-prong test. How far can I go spiritually? Prong one, prong two, without harming another. And then you'll know. And once you've gone through all of this process, and again, this relates to this cheating example, then we know we've done everything we can. And that's all we can do. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Okay, that's what I just said. How far can you go spiritually without harming another? So, what we need to understand now, I mean, Bill does a lot of talk on steps 8 and 9 here. So, he talks about why maybe a reverse role of this. What happens if the non-alcoholic spouse cheats on the alcoholic? Well, wow, now we have justifiable anger, don't we, as alcoholics? So he goes on to explain why a wife that's a non-alcoholic or a husband that's non-alcoholic makes no difference, cheats on the alcoholic. Well, you have to understand that even though we feel like now we're entitled to be angry, people cheat also for a quick fix. because the alcoholic partner is controlling, demanding, and manipulating. So if you are an alcoholic, you know exactly what you did to drive your spouse out to look for a quick fix. We've been giving them no peace, no serenity in the household. We're constantly criticizing them. We make them feel like they're walking on eggshells by controlling everything, their behavior, their actions. We demand things from them that are unreasonable. We manipulate them. And then eventually they go out and they decide to cheat because they need help too. They're only human and they need support and they need comfort. And so they cheat. So, and then what we do is we come back around. And then we cause, so basically to summarize, we cause the jealousy and bitterness in the first place. Okay, that's what the alcoholic does by being controlling, demanding, and manipulative. And then they seek revenge. The other partner, your partner, they'll seek revenge for what the partner did in the relationship to it, to retaliate to it. So in the first, they seek revenge for what the partner did in retaliation to the controlling and demanding behavior we caused. And then in the final outcome, the poor alcoholic feels guilty and remorseful. So when you're guilty and remorseful, you get angry, and we treat them even worse. Because now we can say, you did this, it's your fault, when in fact, we're the ones who created the problem in the first place. So that whole scenario is explained on the, on top of page 82, through the middle of the page. So we have to understand the jealousy was aroused because of us. Remember in how it works, where did we arouse jealousy, bitterness, and suspicion? Well, this is an example of that. So we have to keep in mind that just because the partner committed an act that most people would say is unforgivable, we caused we rolled that whole ball in motion in the first place, because we usually marry some really great people, and we cause them so much pain and misery that they have no other alternative but to seek a quick fix as well. And that sometimes involves cheating. So what we do is we cause all this hypertension and all this crazy craziness in the family. So we go down to the bottom of the page in 82 and read the third full paragraph. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He's like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" So, you know, not drinking and just doing steps 1 through 7 isn't enough. Even if you've gotten that far. If you've done 1 through 7 and don't want to do 8 and 9, you need to go back and do 1 through 7 again. Because if you don't see that you've created a whole heck of a lot of harm and roared through your family life and the world like a tornado, destroying lives and hurting others, and then when the wind stops blowing and you realize that, wow, you know, it's over, the storm's passed, and you don't feel like you have to do anything but just not drink and not repair any damage, then you are far from recovered and still very delusional. And you will slip back into your drinking habits over that. So he goes into the next paragraph on page 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead, a remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, and kindliness and love. So A remorseful mumbling, yeah, I'm sorry, you know, that kind of thing. Well, we've heard that all before while we were drinking. We didn't really mean it. We need to understand that there's a long, long period of recreation of our lives and reconstruction that lies ahead. We can't criticize them, even though they have glaring defects. Now, what are their defects? Again, they could be very selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate, and fear also. So that may be apparent, but we now have the tranquility in our mind to see them, and that you know, we were partly responsible. How could they forgive us or trust us? Let's just say, forget forgiveness, trust us up until this point. The storm has just ended that we caused. So now it takes time to clean house. So if we don't clean house and we just try to jump right to living in the dirt, then we are going to not gain trust. We're not going to be recovered. And eventually we'll go back to drinking. So we need to ask God for help in our meditation. We ask our creator, the universe, whatever it is for you, for the patience and tolerance and kindliness and love. Patience, kindness, tolerance, and love. That's what we're trying to bring out of ourselves. Like I said before, the drop of God is patient, tolerant, kindly, and love. And it's in within every human being. So if you're willing to remove your character defects with the help of your higher power, those four other things are just going to automatically start to shine through you. You don't have to pretend to be patient when you're not, because patience will just come. Same with tolerance, kindness, and lovingness. You'll be able to do these things with the help of your higher power, because your higher power doesn't have defects. Only the ego does. So, like I said, your ego, as long as you have a body and mind, will always be present, but the defects can be dissipated to a point where you are as spiritual as you can be, and those four things of spirituality constitute patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And those are within you already. So, get your defects out of the way, remove the guilt and remorse. And you'll start to see those things come out of you automatically. So now we'll read the next paragraph of 83. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. So now we're talking about, you know, of course they're not going to be exactly trusting of us immediately. They're going to be skeptical. They're going to want to see the proof in your behavior. That's how you make living amends to your closest friends and family, by your new behavior. And that takes a long, long time. It can take, you know, years, but eventually they'll start to soften up. If they truly love you and want you in their life still, then you'll repair that damage over time, not in one conversation. We have to live a spiritual life in order to do that. Because if you don't live a spiritual life, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to start. Your ego is going to resurrect, and you're going to cause more damage. And eventually, may or may not drink. You could be a dry drunk and just stay miserable, and that is not going to repair any damage either. So you don't want to, you know, hammer them with spiritual matters and how they need to change too. That is up to them. We can't change other people. They'll start to see the benefit in this if we have a desire to do this. They'll start to say, "Wow, you know, the human condition really does." Can change, and people can change. Your personality, you know, will change, and who you are will be revealed, not who you pretended to be all those years. That's basically what we're trying to do in 8 and 9. Lastly, he's talking about, you know, amends that we may not be able to fully write, but we are willing to make amends if we could, then that's enough. You know, if somebody's passed away and we can't make amends, if we were willing to, then your God will know that it's not possible to correct that damage. So the willingness will have to be enough for you, and it is enough for God. But if damage can be repaired, then you better do it. Because you can't fool yourself and say, oh, I'm willing, but it's possible, but I'm not going to do it. Not good enough. Not good enough. It's not enough. So you're really going to have to soul search on whether or not you're rationalizing or whether or not a right can be corrected or not. And if it can, then you do what you can. Like I said, you can't change the past, but you can repair based on the conditions in the present. No matter how little or how much that is, depends upon the situation. One of the things that he does say is we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. So if you're servile or scraping, you're maybe giving in to demands of the other person that are not acceptable, because you think that you owe them more than your higher power wants you to make restitution. So now their ego is taking advantage of you. So, that's something you'll need to discuss with your higher power and another human being, your sponsor primarily. If I'm making amends to an egomaniac that I've harmed, yes, I have to clean up my side of the street. But if they're sick in their disease, if they have a disease, or if they're just egomaniacs or narcissists or whatever, and they're asking me to do things that are unreasonable based on the harm that I've caused, then I'm being servile and scraping and want their approval. And that means I'm back in my disease and I'm being taken advantage of. So you need to be careful that you understand that you're not a doormat. You're not a doormat, but at the same time, you're not there to point your finger either. So it's a fine line, and you need to be humble and have a tranquil mind before you approach anybody. And don't skip steps. If you don't have humility and counsel, don't make an amend. Counsel meaning from a sponsor primarily. And then he gets into the ninth step promises, which I will read in the next podcast. But we talked about in the ninth step podcast. But we talked about the difference between the bedevilments and the ninth step promises. So now that you've done, if you get to 2 through 9, your mind is no longer in the negative, but is now starting to think in the positive. So if you look at the Dropbox, you'll see that I uploaded that sheet on what a bedevilment corresponds directly with the ninth step promise. So you can't remove your bedevilments and your misery without going through steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. That's 7 steps more before you can get to the promises after step 2. So remember, if you skip from step 2 to 9, you're not going to make amends. You're just in your ego still, and you're going to cause more harm because you have not done the work. And the work is a four-letter word that alcoholics do not like. They want what other recovered people have, but they don't want to do the work. And if they don't do the work, they will not get what other people who have recovered have. So that is where we're going to finish off today. So yes, 8 and 9 are combined and discussed in this step, but this is again a high-level overview podcast, so you can understand why we're doing these steps and what the book says about them. Next time, we're going to go into step 8 in the 12 and 12, so we can talk about why the alcoholic rationalizes the willingness to not do step 8 and 9, which is just as important as why we do it, because the alcoholic mind is extraordinarily powerful. And we will come up with reasons that we believe that are to be true not to do this step or these 2 steps, especially with certain people. So that's when the rubber meets the road, when we start getting to the never pile and we gain enough humility and understanding to do our best to make amends to those we said we never make amends to. So I like to use the football analogy. It's like taking the ball to the 99-yard line and spiking it. It does not get you a touchdown. There are no points for taking the ball to the 99-yard line and spiking it. We have to walk it all the way in or run the ball in order to do so. Not that this is a game, but we tend to do that. And then we'll say, well, I took it this far. Why shouldn't I get the guilt and remorse removed. Why? Because you didn't make amends to that parent or to that best friend or to whoever it is that you don't think you owe one to, that you absolutely do. So we'll finish here. God bless. I have been away on a trip. So if you're an ongoing listener, welcome back. And I can start getting more of these podcasts out more frequently now. And I hope you have a wonderful day and evening. And I love you all. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.